come sideways, some come straight way.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you for coming out to the first episode of the Underground Footy Podcast. My name is Mos Ray. I'm going to be the host, and I'm not going to do any kind of fancy business. As you can see, I've got Eddie Pope on the scene, and we're going to talk about some of the pathways for youth development and all the way to the pro game. Now, obviously, there's a whole lot that encompasses, but first I want to kind of let you know, if you don't know about Eddie Pope, you know, being from the DMV or District of Columbia, Maryland and Virginia, this gentleman here got DC United their very first title. He was on that team. I won't say he got it by himself, but you were definitely a big piece coming out of UNC, and you were on three of those teams. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, three.
You were on three of those teams. Yeah. You also played for Metro Stars.
Yep.
And I'm originally from, I was born in New York and raised in New Jersey. So, I mean, you've been on a pathway to do great things and doing great things for a while. But what we're going to talk about today is also you are the North American representative for Octagon Sports Agency, which I see that you guys handle a lot of different athletes, but you specialize in the soccer division.
Correct. Soccer division.
All right. So let's start out with who are some of the players that you guys represent over there?
Well, some obviously you would know is Ja'Cory Hayes. From this
he's from my town. Yes, Bowie. Yeah. Bowie, Maryland.
Yeah. Jacob Green.
Another one of our guys.
Donovan Pines.
Win like two state cups in futsal.
Yep. Oh, okay. Yep.
Donovan. You didn't Pines. Know that, did you?
I did not know that.
Yep.
Donovan Pines.
University of Maryland, my alma mater. There we go.
Yeah. So I mean, yeah, we've got some kids from the area.
Okay, cool.
You know, this is clearly a hotbed for soccer for Black players, and I want to do more of that. I want to make sure that the Black players in this area, number one, have place to play, facilities to play in, good coaching, but also that we want them to have that platform, whether they choose to go play in college, or whether they want to go further than that, or rather farther than that. I want to be able to make sure that those kids have those opportunities. That's what I'm hoping and looking to do. And I know that there's a lot of history in this area in regards to soccer that most of the country doesn't know about. We're going to got to continue to put it on the map.
All right. I see that you're from originally you're from North Carolina. Is that correct?
Yeah, I'm from High Point, North Carolina. Yeah.
High Point, North Carolina. So let's just talk about your pathway specifically. All right. So when did you find out about soccer? I mean, was it cultural? I mean, is it something your family did or?
No, it's not. And it's, these conversations always can kind of like dovetail together. But, this area clearly there is more Black people to know about soccer in this area, especially when I was growing up, right? So in the DMV area, I mean, we can go back to all the players that have come out of this area. But in North Carolina, that just wasn't the case. So the way that I ended up playing soccer was that I wanted to sign up for football. But I was too young at the time. And I missed the registration for a couple other sports. And the only thing left was recreational soccer. And so, my father was like, well, you want to try it? It's better than not playing anything. And reluctantly, I was just kind of like, yeah,
wow,
I guess I'll try it. But I want to play football, though, as soon as registration comes back around. And so that's how I discovered soccer. And, he was one of our coaches. They didn't know what they were doing. My father grew up playing football and baseball and stuff like that. So we really had no clue. We were all just winging it. We didn't have a you know, a multicultural or multi-ethnic community in High Point, North Carolina. It's very rural, very, you know, Black people in one area, White people in another area. I mean, it just, we didn't have that international crowd, and we didn't really have people to choose from to come and say, hey, this is how you play the game. We just, we were winging it. And so, yeah, so that's how I got started. It was almost by, it was dumb luck. So I played it that first year. It was terrible. I'm surprised my parents brought me back out for the next year, but they did. Because
I wanted to what position were you playing?
Stand in the back, hold on to the goalpost, kick it if it came to you, you know, that position. It wasn't anything specific. Right. But then after a year, maybe a couple years, I started to get the hang of it and loved it, and I stayed with it. So,
all those parents that are taking their kids out to these, you know, little kids training sessions, and they might hop on your lap, or they just want to watch, or climb the trees, or do whatever these things are. Just have faith, let them keep watching, and when they realize it's fun, they'll most likely jump out there with them, correct?
Oh, absolutely. You never know. You never know. I've coached everything from four-year-old little girls, and mm-hmm. four-year-old little boys, all the way up to, you know, older kids, teenagers. And, and you know, with the little ones, you know, I'll say, a parent will say to me, oh, they just don't seem like they like it, or, you know, or you got one kid who's dribbling through everybody, and the other parents like, well, you know, that's how it should look. And I say the same thing that you just said, you know, if they're having fun and they like it, you never know where it might go. Let them bring them back out again, let them play the next season. And sure enough, the kids that stick with it, they end up catching on to it, end up loving it. And you know, playing the sport through their teenage years.
Right, right. Okay, so now you're playing as you know, are you playing rec, or did you go into travel soccer? I mean, you came a long way. So at what point did you get to the next step?
Yeah, I mean, so I played recreation soccer. So you're talking about, this is early 80s. Early 80s. So, you know, there wasn't a lot of soccer in North Carolina at that time. So I was born in 73. So there were no teams our age, travel teams our age. So as I got to be about 8 years old, we started to try to have a travel team, but there was nobody to play in our area. So we would play 3 years up, 4 years up. We were just trying to get games.
Now, what was the demographic of this team you're talking about?
It was me and everybody else. That's the demographic of the team, and any team we would play. And every now and then, as you know, especially, you know, so I guess some in this area as well, every now and then you'll see a team, they got a Black player on it. Right? And you see another team and they got a Black player on it. And you see
did you do the salute when you saw them?
And your parents are doing the salute, and they're having a conversation on the sideline. And you obviously, you know, you recognize them, and on the coast where, you know, the military bases, there's a little more color, but not a whole lot. You know, Fort Bragg and Fayetteville and stuff like that. But so then, you know, as time went on, there became more 73 teams. Remember back then it was like by, you know, 73s played 73s and 70, everything was, there was no U8s. We talked about it differently. So then going through those travel years, more teams came on board. It became a sort of a regular travel thing, a regular thing. There were lots of teams in our age groups. You know, the State Cup came about. You had those competitions.
So you won some State Cups?
We won one. I won one State Cup. I won one State Cup.
It's a tough road, right?
Tough road. And back
what,
then.
What around what age group is that? Did you participate every year from, you know, 8, 9, 10? What was the start of the State Cup runs?
Oh gosh, I mean, well, it certainly wasn't when I was around 8 or 9, because we were the only team, just kind of like in our area. You know, so we would maybe have to travel 1.5, 2 hours to find one other 73. And then maybe you got to go a couple hours, to find one more 73. And then maybe you got to go to South Carolina to find one. There weren't very many. So, but I would say maybe around 10, 11 is when State Cup.
Okay. So So now you're rolling along. How did you become identified that you had some potential?
Well, you know, look, I mean, for me, that was very late. You know, as I, you know, went through the travel years, eventually ODP came on board. It was all these things were brand new. Mm-hmm. ODP comes on board, and all the politics that come along with it were certainly there. I missed, you know, certainly missed out on that a couple of times and latched on to it a little bit. And by that time, what was happening is that the coaches in the area, the college coaches in the area, you give them a lot of credit because, you know, they had time for a lot of the local club teams because they knew there were a lot of dads coaching and things like that. So whether it was a Guilford College in my area, a High Point College, which is now High Point University, mm-hmm. we were over there playing around a little bit. And then as I got older with the Olympic development team, Wake Forest, Jay Vidovich, who's now up here our way now.
He's in Pittsburgh, right?
He's at Pitt.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, Alan Dawson, ODU. These individuals, UNCG was another school who had, you know, even some of their players would come and help. That's where you really got that soccer knowledge from in North Carolina, the surrounding community. So once ODP came on, after missing it a bunch of times and then kind of latching on a little bit, I went through that system and played that throughout, you know, high school and things like that. And then went to college at UNC. And, you know,
that's how long was it? When did you know, hey, I'm going to UNC?
Not until maybe 2-3 months before.
Really?
Really. You know, my goal was to go to Wake Forest. It didn't work out. The last minute, they sort of said no. I was kind of like flailing in the wind. And then I got lucky enough for some things to come together. You know, I kicked field goals in high school, and that helped me get into UNC.
Right.
And then they kind of heard that I was going to play football at UNC, the soccer team. They're like, oh, well, then we thought you were going to Wake. Long story short.
Wait, time out. So you actually went as a football player?
Football player.
An American football player.
American football player.
Because, see, I had read that you had kicked, but I was like, oh, they must have seen him and said, hey, can you kick? Maybe somebody went down. You were actually brought there to kick.
So, yeah. Semi-long story, but.
See, the pathway, I just want people to know, you can't call the pathway.
It's impossible.
It's lovely to just map it out, but nobody's pathways are the same.
Absolutely not. And you know, my whole thing was, hey, I'm going to go play for Wake Forest. The assistant coach is my ODP coach. This is what I'm doing. I know this is going to happen. This is, excuse me, and all that. Like you said, I got the pathway laid out perfectly for me. But I was also kicking field goals in high school. And what I didn't know, my kicking coach sent my kicking tape, all my field goals, just around to some of the schools, and he sent it to UNC. So I'm coming out of the school one day in high school, and I see somebody walk up from UNC, got the whole gear on, everything. And he said, hey, we know we've been watching your kicking and blah, blah, blah. And I had no idea because I didn't know that my coach had sent this tape around. And so again, long story short, he was like, hey, you can come to school, you can kick. We have a scholarship for you. Wake Forest had already fallen through. I wasn't really sure how I was going to go to, could afford to go to college, or how I was going to go to college, or how I was going to pay for it, or where I was going to go. So again, long story short, boom, I end up at UNC. The soccer coach finds out that that I am going to come to kick, and he goes, well, you're going to play soccer too, right? And then that's where it all merged together. And so it's it was a very odd pathway. And I only, you know, I ended up kind of training with the football team and all of that. But then that kind of fell off as the potential for me to make the Olympic team, which meant I had to leave school for a semester, came through, and I had to choose soccer or I had to choose football. And I ended up choosing.
So you had the potential to go and try out for the Olympics at the same time that somebody thought you weren't good enough or didn't recruit you to come to their soccer team that was in your backyard for all intents and purposes.
After my freshman year of playing, yes.
Yeah. Oh, so they saw you playing at that point. Between me and you, did you get a chance to play against Wake Forest?
Of course. And you already know what happened.
Did you punish them?
You already know. Every time.
Now, that's something else I want to say to all the young players is you will get an opportunity to punish anyone who maybe doubted you. Take advantage of it when it comes.
That's the beauty. You know,
and have fun. That's the main thing with this is to have fun.
Yeah. So, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay, so tell me about how you left UNC because you had to prepare for competing to be in the Olympics, trials and all of that stuff, right?
Yeah. I mean, it took, you know, there are a lot of trips that you had to take ahead of time. And, you know, sometimes you're gone for a month. And so you're kind of coming in and out of school. And then eventually it got to the point where, you know, we went into residency to try to make the, if you're really going to residency, you haven't made the team. You're going in there to make it. So you're losing a semester of college just to go do this tryout and make the final roster. And so once you get to that point, you know, you're all in. And so, you know, but leading up to that, you know, it's you know, trying to make the Olympic team and what's the ODP used to be steering everybody to, there are a lot of, you know, a month here, a trip to Argentina to play in this Pan Am Games, and a trip here, and this constant evaluation. And so you're missing a lot of you could be missing a lot of school, but I was certainly going to be missing a lot of football. And so obviously the two just didn't work. So, yeah, I mean, I was in that system and in that program, but nothing was assured. Nothing was guaranteed. I certainly didn't. I never made youth 15. I got the youth national teams go back so young now. But 15, 16, 17s, 19s. We don't have 19s, but 18s now. The U20s. Mm-hmm. I never made any of those teams.
Yeah, and like I said, the people I've seen really motivated by those perceived snubs, you know, like a Weston McKennie, for instance. You can see that's the kind of thing that can drive a player. And I also think that, you know, that's another, you know, we've talked about, like, so now we can kind of step into some of the stuff with, you know, headed towards pro. It seems like in the American game, people fight to get on that U.S. national team because of the opportunities it can afford you. It gets foreign powers to watch. I understand if you're trying to get to Europe, it makes it easier to get your work papers and things like that. There's all kinds of criteria for getting working papers, even for an American player in Europe. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, the way, you know, for example, now with Brexit complicating a lot of different things, but in a normal world, right, you, for example, if you want to play in England, so you're either going to have that EU passport, which now, again, with Brexit, probably doesn't even really help you. But
unless you're going to England.
That's what I'm saying. If you're going to England.
If you have an English passport and you're trying to go to England, it can help you.
It can help you.
But now it has about as much weight as an American passport or a Argentinian passport.
Well, you used to be able, let's say I had a Spanish passport and I was in the EU, well, then I could go into England and I won't count as a foreigner. But now with Brexit, that's changed. If I have an English passport, then I'm good to go in England, Brexit or not. But still, in order, in some countries to get that work permit, they want you to have played a certain amount or a certain number of national team games over the last 2 years. And now they've just moved to a somewhat complicated point system, meaning, and these are for senior players, these are for older players, some sort of a point system where, depending on the league that you currently play in, you get a certain number of points. Depending on where your team finished, I believe that's one of the categories. In a domestic competition, you get a certain number of points. If you played in those games, you get a certain number of points. And then based on the number of points you get, will determine whether or not you can get that work permit. So it's gotten a little more complicated than it used to be. And then in some countries, for example, like Holland, the criteria is you can only make a minimum amount of money. So maybe that number is $250,000. That's how they control foreigners coming in.
We had a little technical difficulties, as you can see. Eddie's changed rooms. We were talking about the pathways for American players and some of the things you deal with if you're trying to go into the European markets. And so I will let you go with that, sir.
Yeah, I mean, I believe we were just sort of just discussing with, you know, really with how kids are getting to Europe. Like you said, some of the roadblocks, you know, who can go, who can't go, and things like that. And I mean, you know, really, especially for this, you know, the senior level, you know, you have to have played a certain number of national team games and over the last 2 years, you know, so that you can qualify for a work permit. More specifically in England, I'm referring to. Now there are obviously some complications with Brexit. And just because you have an EU passport now doesn't mean that you can get into England now or not count as a foreigner. But now, you know, there's a points-based system that's been instituted, which can be a little bit complicated. You know, it's basically like, you know, what league you play it in or you're playing in, that gets you a certain number of points. What domestic competitions did that team play in and what place did you finish in? Those are some points. How many national team games have you played? You get some more points. And then you have to meet a certain number of points in order to be able to be granted the work permit for England. And so it gets a little bit complicated. And then if you have, you take Holland into, or the Netherlands into consideration, you know, what they do is they say you have to make a certain amount of money. And that's how they kind of control the number of foreigners that come in. So let's say that number is 250,000. Well, as a foreigner, you have to be on a contract of at least 250,000. The number may have changed a little bit right now, but the point is that you can see that they'll keep out players that a team does not think is worth it. So if they're bringing somebody in and paying them, and that's where they're starting to pay him, that's certainly going to be a player that's going to contribute from a work standpoint to the country. In Germany, you know, you don't have the same rules. It's a lot easier to get into Germany. And that's why you see so many Americans in Germany right now. It's very friendly. Their rules are very friendly. It's easy to get in if you're good enough, obviously. And yeah. So, you know, it just depends on, you know, what country you're looking at. You know, if you're under the age of 18, you know, you can pretty much forget about it unless you are going there for maybe some kids can get there through school reasons. There are a couple of little loopholes here and there, but if you're under 18, I mean, it's, you know, you can almost forget about it. And so, you know, what is happening though, is that other countries, especially Germany, but other countries as well, they're starting to see that American players are developing really, really well from a technical and a tactical standpoint. They know that they can come over and survive now. A lot of younger kids are well-traveled. So, you know, you'll see kids who just don't get as much of the culture shock as when, you know, be like my age going over there. If I had gone to 16, 17, I mean, it's just the world is so much smaller now because of technology and things like that. So they notice those things. And then, you know, they notice that kids, especially the ones in some of the academies, again, just from a technical and tackle standpoint, are further along than where we used to be. And they like that. It's a different kind of player. A lot of times we're super athletic. Maybe we're more athletic. Maybe we have something that they don't have over there. And and they like that. So the world is changing slowly, but it's changing in that regard.
Okay, now I'm going to go to your thoughts on the MLS academies, and then obviously USL is starting to open academies, and also there's places in the country that are just not covered, and I want to talk some about the scouting that has to go on a country of this size. So when you look at the MLS academies, obviously we had the collapse of the DA, right? MLS Next, I guess you would say, picked up the mantle. Some people say, well, you basically just change drivers as far as who's running it, because it's the all the teams are pretty much the same. And I believe some places have opened up for, you know, travel teams. I know some of the local clubs have joined that platform as well. So how do you feel like what's changed in the way that the MLS academies are handling their players at this point? Like, let's say from when it started to the middle, like when the DA started, excuse me, to the middle to where we are now, which is hard to tell. I understand because of the COVID and things like that. But what's your perception of it?
Yeah, you're right. It's hard to tell because, you know, we made this switch and then COVID happened. So it's, you know, it's going to be really hard to figure out where this is going to go. You know, doing away with the DA shook things up on the boys' side and on the girls' side, too. The girls were getting themselves going.
That's right. You have a daughter that I hear is quite the baller.
Yeah, I have a daughter who was in the DA, who's been affected by some of this stuff. And you know, you have the DA or ECNL on the girls' side. Now it's DA. I mean, DA is gone. So now the GA has come about. And the boys' side, obviously, you've got MLS is next. And, you know, I think what they're saying is that, you know, there may be a little more involvement with your quote unquote regular clubs and the MLS Academy. So where you would have an MLS club, the personnel work with the local clubs. So you'll have MLS Next and you have the Pathway to Pro partners that are some of the local clubs, or the ones that have chosen to be a partner. And the MLS club will, for all intents and purposes, scout in some way, shape, or form. How did they start to do that? I don't know. Scout those players in those clubs and bring that group of players together, and then bring the ones into the academy that they feel are ready. And so, I mean, that's maybe a little bit of the difference. You know, I'm sure there will be, again, we don't know because of coronavirus, but there'll be some league play between the MLS Next partners and teams and things like that. You know, I think the challenge that the U.S. has always had is trying to identify, number one, talent. Number two, right. You have leagues and you have, you know, in everything from a parent to state associations, to clubs, to at some point MLS academies, and everybody's fighting each other. And there are a million different leagues and everybody wants to be the main league. And everybody wants to have control, and this is the way it should be done. And inevitably, a lot of times the players suffer. And you know, we need, and it's a big country, and we know this, but you know, we need a system, right? And we need a system, and maybe the system is that the country's divided up into regions as it is, and you do what's best for your region. You know, I can tell you right now, right, if you look at the DMV area, most teams and most players don't even need to drive outside of the DMV to find a good game. I mean, it's here. You can find those games. I don't need to fly to Seattle to play a game. It doesn't make any sense to me. So, you know, but again, you have leagues and people want to have regional championships and people want to have national championships. And it just becomes a little bit of a mess. And so I think everybody's trying to figure that out now. I think because of COVID-19, I think people are realizing a little bit, oh, wow, you know what? Because I can't travel, I'm forced to play these games with people in my area. And, that team is actually pretty good. Or we did better than we thought we were going to do. That was a good game. It's starting to kind of to figure it out a little bit. And, you know, for all intents and purposes, I mean, we all hope that things will open back up sooner rather than later. But if it doesn't, when we got to get on with it, and the kids have to safely be able to play who's around them. So I kind of say all that to say the scouting is difficult, but it can be done. If you're looking from a collegiate standpoint, and, you know, a lot of people won't want to hear this, but do we need to really take a team from this area to go play in the Surf Cup? Because none of the girls on this team are probably going to go to college in California. More than likely, they're going to college on the East Coast somewhere.
Right.
And so when you start increasing costs for families, you start eliminating players. And you really start to make this too much of an elite sport. As far as college scouting is concerned, plenty of schools on the East Coast, plenty of schools on the West Coast. We have schools all over the place. And I think that we have to use a little, we have to make sure, again, that the sport is available to everyone. But when we are going out of our way to create cost, it doesn't make sense to me. And the last thing I'll say with U.S. soccer, it's hard. How can you scout an entire country? We have states the size of some countries. So it becomes really difficult for them to be able to blanket the whole nation. And I think, you know, they've had to cut back on that a little bit as it is, and which now it means that you're relying upon the coaching staffs within your local market to kind of put you forward to a program, or whether it's a, you know, an ID2 event, or whether it is a GA event or ECNL event or MLS's next event. You're relying upon the coaches and coaching staff to find those best players and to get them into the national team program.
Okay. And as far as you look at for, let's say, the agents, like one, something that, you know, a lot of the parents and friends of mine have told me is that they actually are being contacted. It seems like agents are starting to scour the United States. Now, we talked about that some. Now, obviously, they know the pitfalls of, you know, the main first question is, do they have a European passport, or do they have access to a European passport? But how are these guys getting on to these kids? And also, how do you get on to do, what's the earliest, for instance, that you would start looking at, you know, maybe keeping an eyeball on a young player?
I mean, it's really early now, 14, you know. Some cases, there may be some kids that are 13 and you're just trying to keep an eye on them. You know, I think for parents, you know, me having my kids play soccer, right? So I'm a soccer parent. And I think for parents, you know, the first thing is, you know, you want to make sure your child is maintaining their collegiate eligibility, so they're not signing anything that doesn't make sense to them. And you know, signing with an agent would certainly relinquish your eligibility. So you wouldn't want to do that. And then just really trying to figure out the best pathway for your player, for your child. And in some cases, it's better for the child to maybe play through and go to college, because they've done enough as a youth soccer player that they've been able to earn a $200,000 scholarship. Well, that's huge, right? For most of us, that's a big deal. In a lot of universities, all you have to do is go play 1 year, go be on campus for a year, and you're guaranteed that education for life is paid for. You don't lose that scholarship, at least that money. And right. So schools are guaranteeing that. I mean, that's a huge deal. And maybe you play all 4 years in college and then you're ready to play, become a professional. And then maybe there are some players who are younger, 16, 17, and they're ready to go now. And there's an MLS club that's interested, and they're going to bypass college. And so at that time is when you would say, hey, we need to start talking to an agent and figure out what this path is going to look like, because those are some tough and big decisions when you decide to say, I'm not going to go to college. I'm going to come professional, knowing that after 1 year, maybe there's an injury, maybe there's something else. Now I can no longer play college soccer. There's a lot of big, tough decisions there. And, you know, agents are, you know, they're all over the place. So your kids now, because they're on Instagram and things like that, the agents will look for those accounts and they'll reach out to the player. Some agents will say, hey, can you just put me in touch with the parents? And some agents will continue to talk to the player. It just depends on the agent, the agency, and things like that. That's how, and everybody's watching now, because you can find, you know, there are scouting services, there are things you can watch especially from a youth national team standpoint, where you can find games. Agents go to those games. They're watching them. Agents from overseas, American agents, all of that. So it's a crazy world.
Yeah. So, I mean, do you feel like that the pressure that comes from knowing that there's people watching now? Now, they say that in Europe, it's constant. You know, there's always agents at every single game because the system is different there. And that's what some of my friends who have kids that play over, that was the first thing they noticed. They were like, man, the scouting is crazy almost at every level, whether they're looking to bring a grassroots player up into maybe a third division team or so on. So the pathway seems like that's also coming here. But how much pressure do you think that that's putting on the MLS clubs to sign their players younger? And maybe when they know they can't quite get them on the field yet, because I mean, from what I've heard people say, the MLS is a very physical league as far as, you know, relative to some other leagues. Now I can't, you know, obviously I can't tier them. You would probably be better at that. But what, I mean, you played in the MLS, you still watch the MLS heavily. What are the differences maybe between the way it was when you were playing and winning championships and the way the game is played now? What differences do you see? And also, do you feel like that pressure is making things happen faster for the young MLS players?
Yeah, I mean, you know, MLS clubs certainly have some pressure to, you know, let's say they bring a kid into their environment. They're investing into that player. You know, it could be from a host standpoint. It could be just from the standpoint of subsidizing the team fees and the travel and things like that. And they're investing in those players. But you know, they're academy players, so the players haven't signed anything necessarily yet. They haven't signed that contract, so it's open season. And there are certainly scouts from other clubs around the world who are watching. They will be watching as the MLS next, these events start opening. But let's just go back to the ODA events, right, where you've got MLS clubs and they're down in Florida and then all the MLS teams are playing each other. It's full of European scouts. They're all there. And they know they're there to maybe pull a kid out. Well, if you're an MLS club and you feel like, well, I've invested in this player, I don't want to lose him for free, right, to a club when I've already invested in them. And it could be twofold. One, monetarily, and second one's, hey, I feel like this player could help me. And so there's definitely pressure on them to try to figure out what that balance is, when to sign the player, you know, when to let a player go, when to have a player who's just a nice to have on the roster because you think he might develop later. Mm-hmm. So there's certainly pressure on them. A lot of that pressure comes from Germany to try to get kids signed and before they turn 18 and they can go, or really you can do it a little bit before 18. So that's tough. That's tough for them. You know, it's tough for the family. That's a tough decision too. To figure out, now I want to have my kid go to Europe. Europe's not for everybody, right? You know, so you have to be careful with that as well. So if you know, maybe you bypass your MLS club, you don't leave on such good terms, you go to Europe, doesn't work out in Europe, and now you got to come back. There are some consequences there too. Right. So it's a little, it is sort of like the roll of the dice and trying to figure out what's best. And that's tough. And so I'd say in regards to, you know, MLS in Europe and the athleticism and the physicality, U.S. is much more physical in some aspects, but definitely more athletic. And you know, there's a lot, you know, it's all about hard work, running hard, and all those things. And I think for, you know, for Black players, especially in Europe, I think they see that in a lot of Black players. They see the speed. They see the athleticism, the agility, and they also see, you know, they're looking at it from a standpoint. They don't necessarily come in with any biases. So they're matching that with technical ability and intelligence. Sometimes that gets overlooked here. Over here, they're just saying, oh, he's fast. We'll put him in the back. Nobody will run by him. And they don't necessarily look at that, right? They're not coming in with that bias. They're looking at the total package. And so what you are seeing a little bit more are these kids that are able to go over, and they have something that a particular club in Germany or somewhere else may not have. And they like that. And so you'll see more kids in the future as well that are going to start to go over. And then they get over there and people are like, oh man, he's killing it. Well, that's not a surprise necessarily to us, but it may be to others. So that is a pressure that's growing more and more every day in the U.S.
Yeah. And I see it, you know, I mean, like I said, I know I represent Prince George's County Soccer Co-op, right? So, you know, PG Young Boys, okay? Now, I know, having watched the guys, I've been involved with it for about 12 years. And I've seen some of these guys come up and the levels that they've been able to achieve. And I know percentage-wise, it's very high for the number of guys that have come through here. One of the things that I've also noticed is that it's very difficult for these guys to stay and play together, which is why I formed it. So, like, when you hear that, like, you got guys that played with us, we would bring them together just so they could play each other, almost in a Rucker Park type setting, and have fun. Because if the kids lose the fun for the game, they won't get to the next level. And some of this stuff takes the fun out of the game. So, like, we put together most, like, futsal squads. And like I said, I mean, I had futsal teams with some top guys that are in Germany, Spain, you know, guys that are playing professionally, you know, like I said, like a Moses Nyman, a Jacob Green, you know, and these guys are also reaching back for the younger players and training with them and playing against them. So I feel like that's a culture. But one of the things that we have also is, as these guys start developing, clubs come in from all over wanting players. And so it's almost like they don't get to play together because, like you say, they're top guys, and they can play any number of places. And yeah, as you know, there's a hotbed of talent, but there's also a plethora of clubs in the area that are all trying to compete. You know, it's not, to me in this area, it's not as much tiered. The clubs all want to compete. So that can be tricky too. So we try to find ways for these guys to play together. I mean, we even a couple of years ago put together a team of guys that were getting ready to go to college and that grew up in the area. And we played against a local, like, semi-pro team called Motorik FC. And that was tremendous to see, you know. And it's just, to me, if we can find ways even in this area to keep these guys together longer till it's time, you know. And the thing is too, when it's time, the clubs have to be ready to level them on out and be proud of that. Because obviously most clubs don't have a first team. So what's the ultimate goal? I mean, to me, if you're aiming for kids to become professionals, if they fall back, quote unquote, and become really good college players, There's no shame in that. That's awesome, you know? But I don't think, you know, at the highest levels, a lot of these boys are aiming to become professionals on some level.
Yeah. Yeah, no, they are. And I mean, I agree with you in that, you know, there needs to be in Prince George's County, right? That we talked about this a little bit. Mm-hmm. There needs to be a place, you know, there are lots of really, really nice big facilities out in, you know, Western Loudoun, for example. You know, there's a Maryland soccerplex. You know, there are really nice, large facilities. And I think, you know, Prince George's County needs something like that in a nice area and where it's accessible. And, you know, these kids can stay together. Maybe they don't feel like they have to go to another club to get on a certain platform, you know, right. And at the end of the day, right, it is incumbent upon us to figure this out. And we've mm-hmm. talked about a little bit you know, trying to do that and figuring out a way for these kids to be able to play where they live, and to, for it to be organized and for it to be, you know, done really well, and for the facility to be very nice. And then the platform part is easy, that you can do the play that can be taken care of. And so that they're now, you have club teams at all ages, and it's working well. And then I think the kids can stay together. And then, yes, if it's time, because a certain club comes knocking, then that player leaves, but there will be someone behind them for sure.
No doubt. And we can celebrate it, not be like, oh man, now our team's not going to win this match possibly or whatever, because to me, you want younger players and other, maybe an athlete that may have been slightly overshadowed, to be able to step up in there and show what they can do. So, in other words, if you're going to a tournament and a guy's missing, somebody on that team should be saying, hey, it's going to be my time now. You know, now I'm going to show them this guy's good, but I'm good too, you know, or I'm better,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And, you know, so I appreciate that. And like I said, we'll talk more about, you know, because we're looking at, you know, putting some facilities together right here in Prince George's County. And, you know, the other side of it is that when I was growing up, you know, there would be basketball places where guys would travel from all over to play against the very best. And when we throw an open run or a free play, I get people requesting, oh, can I come out? Of course you can come out. This is the world's game. So there's no issue with that. But it's always fun to see if we have somebody coming from, you know, Frederick, Maryland, to come here to play against who they perceive as some of the better players. They want to see how they match up, you know? And I think that that's something that is somewhat overlooked, is the free play. And I know you work some with the with getting those mini pitches put in to the various like, I know there's a bunch of them in DC.
Yeah.
And I think that that's part of it too, is you got to be able to play for free sometimes. So absolutely. that's the other thing, is like, if kids can go somewhere and meet, I know here in Prince George's, you know, they'll go to Allen Pond and you'll see a bunch of kids just playing. Now, all of them can't afford to maybe play travel soccer, or maybe their parents aren't going to feel like, you know, it's not a priority.
Yeah.
But these kids love the game. So my thing is too, are we going to be able to get these kids seen and possibly given opportunities that either the cost is greatly, you know, brought down, or maybe even free, with the thought being, hey, if these guys can't turn into pros, they can help you turn other guys into pros. So it's still an investment. And I mean,
yeah,
most academies, they have their guys they have their eye on, but they also know you need the very best players to help develop those guys.
Yeah, yes. And I think, to me, the talent isn't a question. It's can it be organized? And if it can be organized and the talent isn't a question, then you're going to have a lot of success. And so at the end of the day, you know, most kids aren't going to become professional soccer players. But most kids can go to college. And I think, you know, at a minimum, right, that's to me, some people would say at a minimum, I would say it's probably where you should be looking to land. You know, this is a great avenue for kids to go to schools, right? And if you've done enough and you're in the right environment, there are all kinds of colleges. And a lot of times I always like to say, well, there's a level of college soccer for almost everyone. And then in some cases that the college soccer will get people scholarships. But at a minimum, right, you can go into a school and be a part of a collegiate program, and then you get benefits. Like, you know, you get the tutors first, right? You get to schedule your classes first. You get to live in the dorms that you want to live in first. There are a lot of perks of going into a collegiate program, whatever division it is, and you get those perks. You get, you know, the academic advisor assigned to you. You know, there are some other factors of success that you get just by being a college soccer player. And that is a huge springboard into being a successful student and then moving on and working in the real world like we all eventually have to do. And that stuff, you know, it's crazy, but it starts on a mini pitch somewhere or in a field somewhere. And it is doable. It's very, very doable. And I agree. And I also think that there, you know, we'll have this conversation at some point, but there are also ways to subsidize, you know, a kid that says, you know, hey, well, my family's not going to pay $3,000 for a fall and spring season. And most people don't want to pay that much for fall and spring season.
Even if they have it sitting on their desk, they don't
want to. Yeah, right. So there are ways to get up to, you know, to help pay for that and things like that. And again, it's all about organizing it. And I'll just tell you, I mean, I do think that there's a place for, you know, young youth Black soccer players to be on teams with players that look like them, to be around them, to do training sessions with the kids that look like them, and then maybe branch out otherwise. But there's no reason why there can't be teams like that, where they can't be multiple clubs and teams like that. It happens the other way around. And again, so it's just about getting it organized and having a place to play.
Well, I mean, just as an aside, one of the other things that you deal with when you do, because like I've worked with and had minority teams that have gone to, well, Black teams that have gone places, like we put together a team that went and played. We used to go up to Montgomery County to the SAM League. And so these kids were all like 6, 7 years old. We would play a year up because they were pretty strong players. Maybe I'll stick the link to one of their little games or highlights on here, but
it'd be great.
They would go and play, and there would be other Black parents who would be like, yo, where are you guys from? You know, because they'd never seen it before. And we say, well, we're from Bowie and we train at Kingsford Elementary, right? And they would want to join, but of course they lived up there by the sportsplex.
Right.
But what it was, a lot of them just said, look, I'm just happy that my son got to see a group of young Black players playing, because when I was growing up, not only the people that I played with in Jersey would tell me, hey, Black people don't play soccer.
Right.
My friends would tell me, dude, that's a white boy's sport. Why are you playing? I was like, man, I enjoy playing. And the funny thing is, as I got better at it, they started coming to watch me play.
Yeah.
But you have to have a very strong mind to be, and you know, I mean, I would go places and I got spoken to in so many languages. I assume now, being older, that some of it was patois and some of it was like French and all kinds of, because they were like, he can't be just an American playing soccer, not a Black American.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you know, pulling that out of it as well is that, you know, it's the world's game.
Yeah. And the hope is that, you know, as you know, MLS is saying that they want to do some things on the underserved community front. Mm-hmm. You know, and sometimes half of it's an underserved community. Sometimes half of it is, you know, just individuals within the community getting mm-hmm. themselves together and making things different and changing things. You know, U.S. soccer needs to be pushed to do more. Mm-hmm. I think if they did push to do more, I think we'd see different results at the highest level. Although I think the team looks pretty good now, but I think we have a long way to go. And then there are some sort of, you know, U.S. Soccer Foundation, which is sitting right there in D.C., who does a good job. And so there are a lot of entities that, you know, just need to get that knock on the door. Again, it needs to be organized. Hey, how do we get, you know, things moving in the right direction? But I think when you have so much talent in such a small pocket, you know, it's waiting there to be developed. It's waiting there to be organized. And I know, like you said, you know, the parents want it. Listen, I go out to the field. My daughters, you know, we'll play all white teams all the time. I mean, it happens all the time. And you know, that's everywhere. And we know, though, that, you know, if you start moving out to Prince George's County and in those areas, it can be organized and you can have groups of black players who can play together and enjoy each other, enjoy the sport and make each other better. You have that as well. And, you know, it's like it's hard to explain. But I was trying to tell somebody one time and, you know, but the comment was a good comment and came from the right place, but they were saying, oh wow, you know, this player is, you know, strong, he's big, he's fast, and man, if that player, you know, you guys have a lot of football players in the United States and if they played soccer and if that player, you know, played here like that, right? Mm-hmm. And what I was trying to explain to him was that I grew up in an all black neighborhood, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody's fast. Like that's, you don't know you're fast until you come out of that neighborhood. And a lot of times, right, you're not even the fastest person in your community. Right. And so it's, you know, when you put all those individuals together, right, that, you know, the mm-hmm. development is different than when you come, when you're pulled out and now you're developing, because you can do, so a lot of times you can do more. Well, when I get thrown back in, it's tougher. Yeah. You know, and those are the kinds of little special things that can happen, you know, once you get everything put together.
Yeah. Well, look, I'm not, we're going to probably have to do this again one day. I said, I appreciate you giving me this opportunity because I know I'm not a famous podcast or anything, but you know, we're heading that way. So we got some other guests lined up. And I just think that, you know, having someone such as yourself to share this information is going to go a long way towards making some things change. And, you know, we'll be in touch about various projects. And, you know, just to close it out, I just wanted to know, is there any advice that you would give to parents, particularly of young black players? What would be something you would suggest in order for them to start developing as players?
What would for the parents?
Yeah, just to develop, to put their kids, the types of environments, you know, any tips you have as far as getting them to develop and you know, because like myself, I'll always be available. My information will be at the end of the podcast. If somebody has questions or they want to direct message me, I mean, we're on Twitter at PG Young Boys. We're on IG at PG Young Boys, you know. And, you know, like I said, that's what I do. I try to be a resource for parents and that type of thing. And So, like I said, to be able to bring someone like yourself on is big because we need to see guys that have done, you know, and women. So you know what, we may have to set up one on women's soccer.
Absolutely. You
know, and because I know you can speak on that, and if you have anybody else you want me to bring in for that, hey, I'm open to it because, you know, football is for everybody, and I enjoy watching it all. You know, I don't care who's playing.
I would say that the kind of
I will watch.
To answer your question, you know, my advice to parents, which, you know, not that anybody's not doing this, but is just be an advocate for your child. You know, especially if you have a child who's playing on a predominantly white team, it's you have to be there. You have to be listening. You have to be watching. You know, you have to make sure that, you know, the other parents or coaches that that are there, that things are being done fairly. Sometimes it's just, hey, you know what? This kid is fast, so they're going to be a defender. No, they can be a midfielder too, or they can be a striker, or they can play anywhere. And it's just about, hey, well, guess what? You know, everybody wants to score goals. So then you have some parents, when you're not looking, calling the coach, trying to get their kid up top as strikers, trying to do, you know, at young ages. This is really young ages, right? And so, again, just being an advocate for your child, being there and being on those trips, figuring out a way to be there at all times if possible. I think it's actually more important for us to be there than maybe other parents. And like you, I mean, if parents want to reach out, they have questions for you, I'm an open book. You know, I certainly will answer as many questions as I can. We can do another one where, you know, you read off 20 questions. I'm happy to come in and try to answer what I can to be a resource for kids in the area. Right.
And again, you know, it's just trying to make it accessible to as many people as we can. And, you know, let's see how good we can all get, you know?
Yeah.
So anyway, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah.
And we'll definitely be in touch. And
yeah, thanks for having me on.
For everyone, thank you for tuning in to the Underground Footy Podcast. Again, my name is Most Ray with PG Young Boys. And we're going to try to bring in another really good guest. It's going to be hard to top you, man, but we're going to keep working. All right?
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.